Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Tommy, we've got a really fun episode of TFL Car Chat today. But before we get to that, well, actually, let's tell them what we're going to be talking about.
We're going to be talking about our trip to Japan, where we got to drive some really special cars we don't get in the U.S., and potentially some cars that might make it to the U.S., and we also saw the Tokyo Auto Salon, and we're going to talk about some of our awesome stories.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about the forbidden fruit, the stuff that we wish we got, because I have a huge, huge yearning for a Jimny, a Suzuki Jimny. I'm so bummed that... Suzuki is no longer on our shores. But first, let's talk about our new setup here.
Yeah, so we've got a new studio. You're going to have to be careful with the clinking, I think, Dad.
I noticed that.
That's going to be key, but we've gotten rid of the workbench, and we have a more kind of casual setup, because that's what all the kids are into these days, are casual setups. And we're going to see if it works, and if you guys like it or hate it, be sure to drop us a line below.
How about that?
A little better.
No clinking.
Nice work.
Hold on. There you go.
No, there you go. Now all the clinking is done. Gone,
yeah. All right. So let's start talking about Japan. First and foremost, Tommy, we were hosted by Toyota. They were kind enough to fly both myself and Tommy to Tokyo for the Tokyo Auto Salon, which is this great tuner show, kind of like SEMA in Japan. But one of the things that struck me immediately in Tokyo was just what a huge car culture, what a huge town. Tokyo is for cars.
Absolutely massive. Yeah, and they've got a very different automotive enthusiast base than what we have in the U.S. We got to see some really unusual things, and we also got to understand some of the Japanese tuning culture in America a little bit more. So that was really cool. But one of the coolest things that we did is we were actually able to check out some new Toyota and Lexus products and even drive a couple that may be coming to the U.S., and a couple that we never got in the States. So it was a really special trip. We got to see Mount Fuji. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the forbidden fruits.
Yeah, let's start with kind of a chronological order of what happened. So we flew to Tokyo, and then we got on a plane and flew to Nagoya.
That's right, yeah. So the following morning, after a nice stay in the hotel, they took us into Toyota City, which is where Toyota is headquartered. And it's a very industrial city. It's a lot like what you'd expect out of Detroit.
Exactly.
You know, any kind of city of commerce is what it was like. A lot of kind of nondescript buildings. And Toyota really is the 800-pound gorilla in this area of Japan. I mean, everything there is Toyota branded, and everything is within the Toyota family.
Yeah, and then the other thing you notice immediately in Toyota City is that it's not just Toyota, it's all the suppliers that, you know, that we know. Even some German companies like ZF, I saw a building for them. And obviously, Toyota uses a lot of international parts, and so all those second or third tier suppliers are there as well. So you're right, it's exactly like Detroit, except in Japan.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, it's named Toyota City, but they still have the occasional dealer for other manufacturers.
So you That's might, crazy, yeah.
You might see like a Honda of Toyota City, which is kind of funny. And it's, I believe it is T-O-Y-O-D-A, mm-hmm. not T-A, just like the family's name, Toyota, not Toyota, which is a little bit interesting. But it was really cool to be there. And they took us into a pretty cool museum. This was called the Toyota Kaikon. And it's open to the public. Anybody can go there, as far as I know. And it's got some displays of products that are on the concept side, but it also has a large showroom that feature pretty much the entire Toyota Lexus lineup, which is very neat.
Yeah, so I think we're rolling that video now, and you can see what the museum looks like. And, of course, here I am talking about the fact that we do get the current Land Cruiser, but we don't get this, Tommy. What is this?
What we're looking at here is a 70 series Land Cruiser. Now, this is the highlight of the trip for me. I've always wanted to experience one and go hands-on. Now, let's talk about how this vehicle came to be, right? The Land Cruiser came out in 1951 as essentially a Toyota, I don't want to say copy, but it really was a copy of a Willys Jeep, a utilitarian go-anywhere vehicle. And originally, the FJ stood for F series of engine, and J stood for Jeep, right? Yep. And there were different lineups. There was the FJ40, and then that grew, right? And they had different variants of the 40, and then the 55, and then like the 60 and the 80 and the 100 and the 200 series like we got in the U.S. But in the mid-1980s, the Land Cruiser took two very distinct splits, right? One side of the world continued with the basic utilitarian Land Cruiser, known as the 70 series. The other side, the part of the world we live on, went to a more luxury-oriented Land Cruiser, the 100 and the 200 and the 80 series. Granted, they were available in other parts of the world as well. But the 70 series has been for sale in Australia, in Africa, in South America, and other parts of the world for decades and decades. And why don't you explain what this vehicle feels like? Because it is truly a unique experience.
Well, so there might be some confusion out there if you're watching this on YouTube. If you're listening to it, I'll explain. What you're looking at is a classic. In America, it'd be the 70 series Land Cruiser, but it's brand new, Tommy.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like an old car. It has drip rails and chrome door handles and a completely flat front end, and it has tiny, tiny A-pillars because essentially it is an old car. This is a basic design that's dated back over 40 years, and Toyota just updated it last year to meet modern emissions and power and some safety requirements. But the basis of the car is still basically 40 years old.
Yeah, and what's unique about it, and if you're looking at this on YouTube, you'll see that you can kind of tell it's been modernized because it's got these kind of new modern style headlights. But otherwise, like you said, the vehicle is pretty much what it was when it was originally built. And what I love about this vehicle is when you go on the inside, it still has traditional HVAC controls.
Well, so traditional is like Roman Empire. They're sliders. They're like something from the 90s.
I mean, if you hate screens, this is the vehicle you could buy.
It doesn't even have a radio at all. Like, there's no screen in there whatsoever. There's no sound system.
But notice the modern shifter.
It does. And it's such a, I mean, this is, in my opinion, the definition of a factory resto mod because it has airbags and air conditioning and a modern diesel engine, but it looks and feels like a car from the 70s or the 80s. It was such a cool thing. And the platform is really the phenomenal part about it. It's got a 2.8-liter turbo diesel engine.
Yeah, it's down from a 8-cylinder diesel.
Yeah, although they still make the 8-cylinder, as I understand, V8 diesel. It makes about 370 pound-feet of torque, about 200 horsepower, if I remember correctly. And it's made into a fairly modern automatic transmission, but it has solid axles front and back. It has a mechanical front locker and a mechanical rear locker. So this is about as close to a Toyota Wrangler as you're ever going to find nowadays. And it was amazing to see the quality. These are vehicles that operate in the most inhospitable parts of the planet. If you need to get into the Australian outback, if you need to get deep into the jungle of South America, this is a vehicle that's done it and has done it for years.
Now, you know this is the updated one because you'll notice there's a little hump in the hood, and that's for pedestrian crash safety standards. And so, obviously, this sells not just in Japan but in Australia. I actually was reading some of the comments on the video, and apparently there's like an 8-month to a year waiting list if you want one of these in Australia.
And they're pretty expensive in Australia. I think they started about $75,000 Australian, which translated into U.S. dollars is about 47 grand, but in Japan, they are very affordable.
Yeah, if I remember right, it was like just under 5 million yen.
It was the equivalent of like $33,000, yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. Granted, before taxes and any kind of road fees, which I'm sure are very expensive in Japan. But that is some truly amazing pricing. I mean, we're talking mid-30s for a diesel-powered solid axle, basically truck. It was crazy.
Yeah, and you know, Tommy and I were discussing this along with some of the journalists who were there about whether if you could get it to pass American safety and crash standards and emissions, which you probably couldn't, but if you could, if Toyota could sell this alongside the current Land Cruiser. And because it's so retro and so cool, there's a current Land Cruiser on the video. My thinking was you could actually price this above the current Land Cruiser and sell it as a factory resto mod.
Especially if you brought it in like limited quantities. Like when Land Rover brought the Defender to the U.S. in like the 90s, a lot of those were numbered in the series. If Toyota brought over 5,000 Heritage Land Cruiser 70 series, whatever they wanted to call it, and they were numbered 1 through 5,000, I think Toyota easily, realistically, could sell these for $60,000, $70,000,
$80,000. I think you could price it and position it above the current Land Cruiser.
Yes, because it is such an in-demand vehicle by enthusiasts. That's not to say someone like my mom would ever want one, because from what I was reading in comments from Australian users who live with them, they're pretty agricultural. You know, they are not fast. They are not comfortable. They are not very good on the road. But there is such a pent-up demand for a vehicle like this in the U.S. It would be a shame if Toyota got greedy and priced it at $80,000 or $90,000.
I'm not sure that's greedy. I mean, how much would Icon charge for this?
Yeah, but an
Icon... $250,000.
An Icon's going to have a supercharged V8 or something. They have big V8 engines. They have a lot of leather, right? That's a luxury product. This is a utility product.
So why don't you make this Toyota's version of an Icon Land Cruiser and make it luxurious
because
and make
I don't
it retro?
Want that. And there's already that. I want it to be $40,000 and to have all this capability.
I think, Tommy, what I'm sensing from watching the auctions is that resto mods are red hot right now. Mm-hmm. This is what people want. Now, part of that is because the people with money, let's face it, my generation or older, are getting beyond the point where they want to drive like 60s cars without air conditioning, without power steering, without power brakes. And so they want the amenities of a modern car, yet with the style and character of a classic car. And that's what this vehicle provides.
Hmm.
And so I think you could price it above that.
I think you could, but it would be a shame. Hmm. I think they would sell everyone at $80,000. Yeah, of course I want one. It's awesome. How could you not? I think... The interesting thing about crash safety in the U.S. is, especially if you give it a GVW over its like 6,000 pounds or something, the requirements for the National Highway Traffic Safety NHTSA, National Highway Traffic.
Are you saying you turn into a heavy duty truck?
They're so minimal, right?
Well, this thing's light. I mean, you have to be.
But I don't know how it works. I don't know if it's based on curb weight or gross vehicle weight rating. This thing has leaf springs in the rear, right? You could have a pretty darn high GVW.
I think you'd have to load it up with all kinds of like off road accessories to get it to that, and that may not even count toward the GVW.
I'm not talking curb weight.
Right.
I'm talking
I get what you're saying,
gross what it could hold. Right. It would be heavy enough to qualify, I think. And if you were able to do that, so many of the hurdles you have to get a vehicle through from a crash safety standard go away. It's amazing. I learned this recently, actually. This is a really fun little fact.
Let's hear it.
Do you know why? Another YouTube channel posted a video about this. I forgot the name of the channel, but it's really interesting. Do you know the Lexus NX?
Mm-hmm.
The first generation in the U.S. had this really weird face. Do you remember? Where like the nose was all
puffed
up.
Yeah, yeah.
In other countries, it had a normal face.
So why do we get the weird one?
Without the overbite. Because per U.S. regulation...
We have to be able to kill pedestrians.
Well, that's the byproduct. If your SUV has an approach angle of greater than 28 degrees, it can qualify into a different classification that greatly reduces the regulation surrounding it, which is why the first generation Tiguan, same thing, had such a weird face because they wanted to give it a better approach angle, not for off-road capability, but to put it in a different regulatory class for safety and CARB and all these different reasons.
Well, shall we move on? We've kind of talked about this for a long time. Should we move on to the next one?
Yeah, for sure.
Let's go to the next one. So the next one in this video, there are four cars we're going to be talking about. The next one is the smaller brother or sister to the GR Corolla, Europe gets it, Japan gets it, and we don't get it. I'm, of course, talking about the car that's on your left there, the GR Yaris.
Yes. So three-cylinder turbocharged engine, all-wheel drive, manual transmission.
There it is.
Yeah. Interesting case. So a little bit cheaper than the Corolla abroad.
A little bit smaller.
Quite a bit smaller. Only a two-door versus four. I think it's one of these cars that it's cool to see in person. Americans say they would love to buy it. But this is kind of like the CTS-V wagon, where every journalist, every enthusiast says they want to buy one, and they only sell 500. I just don't.
There's Abdullah. From Pushing Pistons. He was on our trip.
I just don't see.
Coca-Cola, would you please?
I don't see Americans buying this.
All right. So two things. So for Christmas, I got the new Ray-Ban Meta glasses.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm shooting this video with. It's kind of a POV set of glasses, and I was playing with them on the trip. What do you think? Do you like them, or are they too herky-jerky?
The Ray-Ban glasses?
Yeah. Not the Ray-Ban, but the video output of glasses.
I think the video looks pretty good. They're only, the question I have is, why can you only shoot 3 minutes of content? Why can you not change the aspect ratio? Why do they have to be vertical like this? So I think that's kind of a limiting factor. Plus, I don't love the concept of having basically your phone on your face constantly nagging at you.
Well, you don't have to turn them on. You could keep them off.
But you have them on. And sometimes it'll be like walking the dog, and mid-sentence you'll just stop because you get like a note from someone that's being read in your
ear. First of all, I don't have them on. 99% of the time I don't have them on because of that reason.
Hmm.
And so I put transition lenses into them, and I just use them as regular because I need glasses now. So I use them as regular glasses / sunglasses. What I love about them is they can also play podcasts in your ear. So I always forget to bring iPods.
AirPods.
AirPods.
Yeah.
And so it's great to have basically, a podcast player in my glasses because usually I've got those on because I can't see without them.
I also feel like Zuckerberg, these are Meta glasses, right?
Let me get them. Hold on.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Zuckerberg also has all the information I could possibly give him. Does he also need to see what I'm seeing and have access to my head?
Yeah,
I just don't know if that's necessary.
I hear you hold them because you got the tight. So those are the glasses. And the cool thing about when you turn them on, the lenses are right in the little corners. They cost about $300. And when you're recording a video, which is good in Japan, there's a little light that lights up there to let people know that you're recording. So you're not surreptitiously.
Well, we have a prescription in them.
Yeah, that's
what
I said.
Holy moly, that's kind of cool. I guess that's
I have neat. Prescription and I have transition lenses.
Huh.
So I can wear them as regular glasses. So 99% of the time I don't. When I'm walking the dog, I'll use them to listen to podcasts.
Okay.
And the battery life isn't great. They may last if you leave them on for an hour at most.
Yeah, not
maybe
too good.
2 hours, and if you're recording videos. But I just find it very handy to have a camera on my face so my hands are free.
I think it is an interesting perspective. I think that we could use it for like drag racing because you can get like a good sense of what Andre's seeing like when he's drag racing with a truck. But
I can see Tommy. Oh my God!
It is like a little creepy.
I just put him on.
It is a little creepy having a camera on your face at all times. Like remember when we were at the going through the airport? There was just a guy randomly recording something going up the escalator.
That was creepy.
And the only way we knew is because there was a teeny tiny light on the glasses, which is a little weird.
Yeah, I mean, what I do to be courteous is I don't wear them in a public bathroom because I don't want like people thinking I'm being pervy. But as a general, the other thing they do is they're hooked up to Meta, Facebook, whatever, Zuckerberg Intelligence. And so you can ask them questions and they'll answer the questions. So instead of Googling things, you can just say, you know, hey, Meta, what? And they're not on, obviously, because then they would go, bing, you know, what's the capital of blah, blah, blah. It'll tell you or how many Yaris's getting back to the point were built last year. It'll tell you those things. And I think that's handy as well. So I like the look of the Yaris better proportionally than the Corolla, and that's because the Yaris is a two-door, and you can see the Corolla in the background. That's a four-door, so it just looks better as a hot hatch.
But, like, it's not less usable, right? It's only got two doors. It's less powerful. I think that it's just, it's one of, like I said, one of those cars that Americans say they would love to own, but would they actually want it? I'm not so sure. Would they actually put their hard-earned money? I'm not so sure.
Well, there is, to be fair, there is a, what, substantial weight for GR Corollas.
And GR Yaris's.
No, Corollas in America. You still have
you
to wait.
You still have to wait for Corollas?
And they're still selling over sticker in many places. So I think that's a good hint that the GR Yaris might sell here. I always worry a little bit when manufacturers have, and I'm going to call them stereotype about Americans, and then they don't import vehicles because we only love big, in this case, big cars, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, it has been proven time and again that we're just as enthusiastic about our cars as the Europeans, as the Japanese. And if you give us a chance to buy these cars, we will buy them. Now, of course, there have been examples within history
where
they have brought over cars and only journalists have bought them. I get that, I don't think this is one of those.
I'll give you an example. Like the Ford Capri, right, was one of the most iconic cars in the UK.
Yeah, that was a copy of a Mustang. We got the original.
But then they brought the Capri to the US as the Mercury Capri, if I remember right.
And they brought a toned-down Mustang to America. But why would you do that?
Yeah, but that's kind of the problem. Why would you buy the toned-down Corolla when we get the full-fledged Corolla?
Because it's not toned-down.
It's got less, say, 40 less horsepower.
But it's also lighter.
Yeah.
And it's also more usable as a, let's say, a track vehicle because it's, like I said, lighter. It's two-door, which means it's a little bit more stylish.
By the way, Cole is looking up a picture of the Capri.
Okay.
Quick sidebar on the Capri. There's a new Capri that they just launched in the U.S.
You can see both of them there, Cole.
It's the yellow one, it's Cole.
So the red one's the old one, and the yellow one's the new one.
Yeah, you see that? Ford is doing some wild stuff in the U.K. with their small electric crossovers. So they have the ID.4 and the ID.3, I believe.
Yeah.
They have the... that's from Volkswagen, but Ford sells the Ford Explorer in Europe, which is an electric Ford based on an ID.4.
Yeah, the new Capri and the Explorer are basically on the same Volkswagen chassis.
The Capri is also based on essentially an ID.4. They also sell the Mustang Mach-E, which is another car in that same class, and Ford also sells, I think, a Puma electric.
Yeah, Ford, you can keep all those in Europe.
So Ford has four EVs that they sell in the UK that are all basically the same sized EV.
All right, here let me.
What are they doing?
Let me define what I was saying again, okay? If it's a good car,
The Capri was an awesome car.
It was not. It was a copy.
It was an awesome car.
It was people in the UK fall in love with the Capri because they couldn't get the Mustang, but it was still a copy.
The Escort, also immensely popular in the UK, not really much loved in the US.
I'm saying if it's a good car in Japan, if it's a good car in Europe, if it's a good car in the rest of the world, it will sell in America. Mm. If you're being very strategic, let's use that word, and you're bringing in cars because you can share chassis or you have a dealership like Mercury at the time and you need to sell something and you don't have some product to sell, same thing with like the Mercure, remember that? I'm not sure that's going to work.
You know why this car wouldn't work in America?
Why?
And it's just the sad reality of it. Americans do not buy small cars.
This is a stereotype that I'm trying to fight against.
I appreciate that, but the sales number has proven it over and over and over.
I would say Americans don't buy tiny cars. So like the smart.
This is tiny. This is the size of a Mini Cooper.
No, I sat in it. I fit in it.
Yes, you fit in a Mini Cooper too, but the car is tiny.
The Mini Cooper sold the first generation, which was tiny.
Yes.
Not the first original, you know, the
R53.
BMW. Yeah, those sold like hotcakes.
So what happened?
And they're selling less as they make them bigger.
Yeah, but the reason they sold like hotcakes originally is because they were new and hot and exciting. Same thing with the new Beetle. They were the interesting car of that period, but then once the enthusiasts got past them, they just didn't sell. Same thing with the Fiat 500.
You know what?
It doesn't sell. Same thing with the smart car. Didn't sell.
I would love to hear our viewers' comments. Let us know in the comments if you're doing this on YouTube, if you would buy a GR Yaris if Toyota brought it over.
And one more point.
Sure.
How well does the Chevy Cruze sell today?
I don't know. They don't build them anymore.
Exactly. How about the Dodge Dart?
Those are.
How about the Ford Fiesta?
You missed the good part of the car. The Ford, those were not good cars.
The Ford Focus ST and RS and Ford Fiesta ST were awesome cars.
Yeah, until you started blowing up differentials.
I agree, that was a problem.
And blowing head gaskets.
You're right. But the problem is that, Americans really struggle with the compact space.
Well, let us know in the comments below if you think, like I said, that the GR Yaris would sell. So, Cole, if you roll the video, this is one that they actually might be bringing over. And this is something that we really don't have in the U.S., but it's very popular in Asia. And I'm just talking about Japan. I'm talking about, look, my head is down, so I'm not filming other people.
They're really big on privacy in Japan.
Yeah. So this is the Lexus 500H, the LM, which is basically a luxurious minivan. I'm going to use that word because that's a verboten word for many people, but wait till you get a load of the inside of this.
So LM, officially, I'm told, stands for luxury mover, not luxury minivan.
Look at the umbrella.
Yeah, it's got an umbrella. And this one...
Pause the video, would you, Cole?
This one we saw in Japan has these executive back seats.
Yes.
So this is technically a four-seater minivan with lay-flat recliners in the back.
Private jet seats.
It's got a partition between the front and the rear. It has a 48-inch TV. It has full shades across every window so you can black out the inside. It's got tablets to control everything. I mean, this is like Lexus's response to a Rolls-Royce Cullinan, except in a minivan form factor.
And when you think about it, it's actually a better form factor because it's a box and you have a lot more room, so you have a lot more comfort in essence.
And the idea here is this is kind of the executive car throughout much of Asia. So this is a the classification of vehicle, which is very popular in China, very popular in Japan for kind of the upper crust. So this has replaced the S-Class, the 7 Series, and in some ways even the Rolls-Royce sedan, because to your point, you're able to get a lot more comfort into a box than a low slung rectangle, like what you'd find in a sedan. The problem here is it doesn't look, I think, to most Americans as attractive as like an SUV, as an Escalade.
Well, it's funny because we kind of invented the minivan, or I should say Lee Iacocca invented the minivan, and yet kind of the Japanese have run with it.
But it's not the same. They don't necessarily view this as a family hauler, right? Something like a Toyota Alphard or a Lexus LM are viewed more as like luxury transportation, like we would view a Suburban livery car or a Navigator, or an Escalade.
This is a car you're driven in, you don't drive.
Right. Now, here's my theory. Lexus put this trip together. Thank you, Lexus, for making that happen. It was very cool. And they specifically seemed to want us Americans to showcase this Lexus LM. It seemed to be something that they were pushing to the American journalists on this trip. And if you read between the lines, if this was the only Lexus that they had on this trip, and they wanted us Americans to really showcase it, you have to wonder, is this a product Lexus is considering bringing to the U.S.? And I think it very well could be.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they're dipping their toe in the water and seeing if it's warm or not.
So this Lexus we rode in and got to check out, the LM500H, right? We also got to really go hands-on with it the next day. This one had that executive rear seat package with the two seats. My theory is if this car came to the U.S., it would come to the U.S. as like the standard 500H, or they do a 350H, which is to say it would have three rows of seating, likely six seats, and likely a little bit more affordable. So this one we were driving, the equivalent of about $130,000 U.S., but they are a lot more affordable if you don't get those crazy TVs and those coolers and whatever. I could definitely see Lexus bringing in a three-row version. Now, here's the cool part.
It also has, by the way, the world's biggest spindle grill.
Yes.
I mean, look at that thing.
It's bold.
It looks like a whale that's about to intake a mouthful of plankton.
And like talking to folks in Japan that we talked to, they think this is pretty attractive. You see these things pretty frequently and kind of all over the place.
Yeah, they're taxi cabs, they're family haulers.
They're not taxi cabs. They're like...
We were taken to the airport in the Alphard, which is the Toyota version of
Alphard,
this,
yes. But the LM is above that.
Right.
This is like if you run a company, this is what you're driven around in.
All right, well, let's move on to the next one.
But hang on, I want to say one more thing about this vehicle. Yeah. We also were able to be delivered in, I think it was called the Toyota Velfire, which was also a luxury van. And they took us to this car show, which we'll talk about in a sec. And the comfort, this was a three-row, not just a four-seater. The comfort in the third row was unparalleled. I've never been this more comfortable in any third row.
Yeah, once again, big box, it lots had, of room.
Yeah, but it was like, I don't know why the Sienna can't have a third row that's comfortable. The seats folded almost back. You had a footrest that came up.
Well, the Sienna's a different chassis.
It is a different chassis, but this didn't seem that much bigger. But the room in the third row, and you were laid down in the second row. It was like a private jet. It was unbelievable, the comfort back there. It makes the Kia Carnival, which has those crazy seats, seem like a Corolla compared to. It was amazing.
So if you look, the one in the corner that we're about to look at now is probably the most, well, it's as close to a Toyota Rolls-Royce as you're going to get. And I'm, of course, talking about, voila, the Toyota Century.
Now, this is the new Century SUV that they just launched.
A Cullinan competitor. Look at it. Rolls-Royce Cullinan competitor. Look at the shape of the body. It's very similar.
A little bit. You're right. This is like the ultimate in old money luxury.
Hey, Cole, can you find a Cullinan and put it up next to it?
So if you have made it huge in Japan, and you want stealth wealth, you buy a Toyota Century. Very limited production. I think they build like 30 a year. In the past, it's been the only Toyota V12 ever made in the sedan. It's not a flashy car. It's not going to show up all over Instagram. This is a car for folks that don't want to show off. Where the Cullinan, beautiful, right? But this is a car that's kind of flashy. It's very Beverly Hills. You will never see a Toyota Century in Beverly Hills, right? Because first of all, they don't sell them. But first of all, the other part is, who in America would spend $200,000 for a Toyota badge product?
Yeah. Yeah, once again, I mean, this is a product, a car, and you can kind of see the body shape similarities with the two up there. This is a car that, once again, you're meant to be driven in. You would never drive it. I don't think I'd go inside of it because Abdullah killed the battery.
Yeah, we gave him a hard time about
that. I'm going to give Abdullah the entire program. Every time we were about to go to a car, Abdullah had somehow managed to make it hard to operate because he was either doing his shorts or his TikToks. I'm not sure I was able to go inside this thing because they had those little, in Japan, you just obey the rules, right? You don't like break the rules.
We are both huge Abdullah fans,
yeah.
For the record, but it was pretty funny that
it was pretty funny. I'm giving a little bit, but I'm doing it in a fun way, I hope.
But so once again, luxury style of the rear seats, there you go. You can kind of get a sense of it. They get the fold-down recliners. The front seat folds out of the way. It's got these really cool panes of glass that actually turn opaque when you push the button.
Yeah, you can see it right there.
So this is an interesting car, right? And in America, we are so brand conscious about a little bit of everything. Do you have to go take your phone call?
No, I'll just message him.
It would be tough to justify spending over $170,000, but this is the car they spend like 2 weeks on the paint on to get it so thick and luscious and perfect. And it is like the ultimate. It's got like the stable eye center caps, kind of like a Rolls Royce. This is the
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Ultimate in Toyota luxury that they don't brand as a Lexus because it has such a long lore in Japan surrounding it.
And it's funny, out of all the videos that we did, I think at least the shorts, that was the most popular.
Yes. Yeah, Forbidden Fruit. People love seeing what they can't get. It would never sell in the U.S. It just simply wouldn't. No one's spending $200,000 for a Toyota here. But in Japan, like I said, it's a status and an iconic nameplate. So that's why it does so well.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like any of the luxury brands, right? Like, you have to establish its value before you could make it valuable.
What? This is kind of like, do you remember the Volkswagen Phaeton?
Yeah, very similar.
Where it's Bentley levels of luxury, but with the wrong badge on it for Americans. Yeah. It's the same problem.
Yeah, the Phaeton didn't exactly like knock
the
world over.
No, it did not in the U.S., no.
Yeah. So that was the first kind of excursion we did. And then from there, we went to this really interesting, I think it's a classic workshop, but they do more than that for Lexus and Toyota. It's a place where they customize, where they retrofit fit and where they restore classic Toyotas. But they do more than that, but they didn't show us the part that is actually the more.
And I do believe they also do work for the Toyota Heritage Collection. Yeah. And they have some really cool cars. So let's start with the little S800 there. So this is an example of what they do. They do refurbishments and restorations on unique classic cars like this S800. This is a little teeny tiny two-cylinder sports car that Toyota built that never came to the U.S. It kind of looks like a little UFO. It's got a little, I think it's a horizontally opposed two-cylinder engine. Super cool, though. This is like a teeny, teeny, tiny Miata.
Yeah, or an MG.
Yeah, that's a good point. Closer in age than MG, for sure.
I mean, back then, let's face it, Toyota was kind of copying the British, the most popular cars. And why wouldn't you, right? And so they showed us that. But the one that really was exciting was one of the, it wasn't the first GTR, because the first GTR was a four-seater. Four-door. But this was, I think, the second generation of the GTR. It's the white one, Cole. Yeah, that video right there. And this was a car that came out just at the wrong time, because this came out right before the fuel crisis.
Yep.
And they only built, I think, like 150 of them, and this was number 72. It's $1 million car.
It's called the Ken Mary because of the advertisement campaign they used. Actually had two characters, Ken and Mary, in it. It's a very American-style car, though. Yeah,
pause it. What I'm showing there is it's got a very similar slope to a Mustang.
Yeah, and, like, it's got the flares. I mean, you could tell that Nissan was kind of benchmarking the Mustang as a hot little inline six-cylinder engine. This one actually is super rare. It only has, like, 1,000 original miles on it, which is just crazy.
And you got to give up to Toyota for showing us a Nissan.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah. I mean, the Toyota people are all car enthusiasts, and it was really special to see one, the original Ken Mary. I think it's the rarest GTR probably ever, but very super, super rare to find them at all, and to see one in perfect shape was really cool.
Keep rolling it, because I think I get to the engine eventually, which is, you know, the power plant that everybody wanted back in the day.
I think that was called, don't quote me on this, this is going to be wrong, but I think this is the SR20. If I remember correctly, inline six.
Nissan 2000.
Nissan 2000.
Because that's what it says on the... on the engine.
But three carb, yeah, really hot car for the early 70s.
Yeah.
So it was really cool to see. And we saw another car, which is very unique. This is called the Toyota Toyo Pet.
Yeah, it's a blue one, Cole. Show them that one. So this is the first Toyota that was imported, use that picture, into the United States. It's a funny story because this failed horribly in America.
Yeah, the first generation... The first models came in 1958, and this was a good example of a foreign automaker not understanding the needs of America. So it had the chrome, it had the fins, it had the look that Americans wanted, but it didn't have the performance. They were known for being incredibly underpowered, and interestingly enough, on U.S. roads, it also didn't have the reliability. So these cars were known for... the few that they imported exploding, basically blowing up.
Which is funny for Toyota. The first car was the most unreliable car ever.
In a famous publicity stunt, Toyota tried to drive one across country.
They made it to Vegas.
Yeah, LA to Vegas is how far they made it before the engine blew.
Yeah.
So Toyota withdrew really quickly after the first few were imported, and then they didn't come back for quite some time until the introduction of the Land Cruiser to the U.S. So there was a break, and then Toyota built what is that thing? I just drove it. Like the Crown.
Well, this is a Toyota Pet Crown.
No, but I just drove this car from the Toyota Heritage Collection.
I can't help you with that.
It's driving me crazy. It's the little blue guy. Not this little blue guy. They built a car with America in mind that was a massive success. This is going terribly here. I'm looking it up.
All right, go anyway, look it up.
It was pretty cool to see it in person, though. I've never seen a Toyota Pet.
They also had a pretty interesting... 2000, is it 2000 GT?
Like, yes, very, very rare.
The
Corona.
The Corona.
That's what it's called. Yeah, they had a couple 2000 GTs and one with the body off, which was really neat.
That was a James Bond
car
that James Bond drove, but they made it into a convertible for the movie.
Also multi-million dollars, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was cool to see that, you know, that Toyota has a big following in Japan for the classic, the really old cars, pre-70s, and there are people that are agonizing over these cars to make them perfect to restore. So the next day, we transferred from Toyota City to the Fuji Speedway.
Yeah, which is right by Mount Fuji. I took a picture of it. That's you looking at the Speedway right there, and there is a picture of Mount Fuji.
Yeah, it's really cool because we stayed at the Fuji Speedway Hotel,
yep.
Which is owned by Toyota, actually.
It is, yeah, and so is the racetrack.
Operated by Hilton, but owned by Toyota, and not that expensive. One of the things which blew me away about Japan, especially now considering our exchange rate, is how affordable it was. So we were staying in like 5-star hotels, but I was running the exchange rate to see how much it was a night, and it was typically like $250, $280 a night, which for the quality of accommodations, which would be $800, $900, $1,000 a night here in the US, it was amazing. And the Fuji Speedway is the ultimate, the hotel is the ultimate car enthusiast hotel, because on one side you had the amazing view of Mount Fuji,
yep,
and on the other side of the hotel you could watch the cars go around the racetrack.
Yeah, that picture, so there's also a museum.
Yes.
That you could go to in the hotel there, and then you end up at the gift shop, which has a Cole, if you go back to that picture of Tommy, which has a coffee shop, and probably the most fun I was having on the entire trip was just sitting there watching club racing going on the track. I mean, look at the view of that track.
It was really cool.
Yeah, and then while we were there, we actually got to test drive some pretty cool cars. And the one that we have video of is a car that I think Toyota could do well with. It's another car that I think they could import, and that is, of course, the GR Corolla version that Lexus would sell here.
Yeah, so it's got a long, long name. Are you ready? It's the Lexus LBX Morizo RR.
And yeah, that's the one, Cole, yep.
The story behind this car is pretty darn wild. So Akio Toyoda is a huge car guy, right? The guy leading the company. And he loved the little Lexus LBX as a fun little run-around commuter car, you know, to doink around town in. And he had the idea. He went to the engineers, I'm told, and told them out of the blue one day to take the guts of a Toyota GR Yaris and put the LBX on top. And they literally did that. They cut the bottom off of a GR Yaris and bolted an LBX on top of it for a prototype. And this was super unusual for Toyota because Toyota and Lexus are very committee-based, right? Everything has to go up the food chain. Everything has to be approved by all these different layers. But this was a car, the head of Toyota comes to you, says, build it. We're just going to see what happens, and they did it. This was a pet project for him, and you know that because it's labeled RR.
Which stands for?
Rookie Racing.
Which, and rookie is not what you think as somebody who's not good at racing. It's the name of his dog.
Yeah, it's Akio's dog. Yeah. So we have a car.
Who's a novice to racing.
We've got a Frankenstein car,
yeah,
with the name from a dog that was actually put into production, which is just wild. Now, GR Corolla, right, GR Yaris, Gazoo Racing, GR is their very heavily thought out, heavily brainstormed and well-planned kind of performance division of Toyota. RR, I'm told, is Akio's pet projects. So that's what the LBX is. Super cool car. It's a little tiny Lexus. It's sold in many parts of the world as a hybrid. It's just a normal little runaround hybrid, smaller than the UX. It's great for
this one.
It's great for old people. Great for someone that wants a little bit of luxury in their hatchback. But the RR is such a Frankenstein car, and it is such a cool driving experience.
Well, it's basically got that 3-cylinder out of the GR Corolla.
It's a little bit detuned, I think.
Right.
It's more in line with the RS, but still has the all-wheel drive system. You can get it with a manual transmission.
40 less horsepower, so figure 2, what, 60?
It's like versus, 280, I think,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got the same
and you can
manual
the video
too.
And you can see me driving it, and I really enjoyed driving it. This was the drift track next to Fuji Raceway, and I really enjoyed driving this car because, as one of those old people, Tommy, I love the fact that it's taller, it's easier to get in and out of, it's also softer sprung.
Yes, it was pretty squishy compared to the GR Yaris and Corolla.
And this is me using the glasses again.
Yep, I see your POV there, which is pretty cool.
And I've got both hands on the steering wheel, which is nice.
This was my favorite application of that engine, transmission, and all-wheel drive system because it was the most mature. It wasn't as engaging to drive as a Corolla. I haven't driven a Yaris, but not as engaging to drive as a Corolla, not as tossable. Didn't feel as quick because it's quite a bit heavier, but as an everyday car, this would be so much better because
it's... Put on the racetrack. I go on the racetrack. Oh, is that it? I gave you the wrong video. Sorry. Okay.
It's comfortable. It's still plenty quick. It's still got all-wheel drive. It made some great noises. This was a brilliant Frankenstein that works perfectly. It is such a good product.
So I'm talking to Cole, who's our producer, by the way, in case you guys are wondering who Cole is.
But we're trying our new podcast techniques here.
Remember how I said previously that you should bring cars in that you don't? I don't think this would sell here.
What? You think a GR Yaris would sell, but the little... Crossover? Americans are crossover crazy.
No, I don't think this one would sell.
Why?
Because it's too tiny. It's just too tiny.
It's bigger than a Yaris.
Look, here's, well, let's, okay, let me let me kind of take a step back.
Oh my gosh.
All right, and tell you why I don't think this would sell. First and foremost, for the longest time in America, small cars were considered to be economical cars, right? So they were never considered to be luxury cars. So only recently have we gotten to the point where people accept small cars as being something that's premium, something that can be expensive. Europeans have had that for a long time. A good example of that is that little Mini SE that we had, the electric Mini, right? That was $36,000, I believe. And it was a little tiny car, and yet it felt premium inside. The materials were nice. But for the most part, in America, if it's premium, it's like a Cadillac Eldorado or a Lincoln Continental, right?
If you're 80.
No, but I'm saying that was the thought process, and those 80-year-olds, Tommy, have the money, right? You don't. You probably. I don't know if you have the money for this or not. But let's say that car came into America.
Well, let's in Japan. I know how much it costs.
How much does it cost in Japan?
The equivalent of 47,000 U.S.
So if we bring it here, let's say it's 60,000.
Sure.
Right. It's not going to sell. It's just. It's tiny. It really is tiny.
But the Yaris is smaller. The Yaris that you said would sell.
But this is the other problem is it's kind of one of these cars that crosses over two different aspects of cardom that people don't put together. It's a small crossover that's premium and it's also extremely sporty, right? So it's like a sporty crossover. And outside of BMW, we were just talking about that recently. None of the Japanese bring sporty small cars to America, at least not crossovers, right?
But
there's no Japanese version of the BMW X1.
Yeah, it's called the Marizo RR.
But not here in America.
But I'm saying they could bring it over and they would have one.
I'm saying the Japanese don't do that.
But why not?
I don't know why they don't.
So they should. Because look,
you're just like arguing with me.
It's not just BMW, though. BMW has the X2, right?
Right, or X1. This would be more
X1. I don't think they do an X1 anymore. Do they still do an X1? Oh, maybe they do an X1.
I think you're right. Europe.
No, they do an X1 here as well. This is a little, I think, of the X1. The X2 is a coupe version.
This is smaller
But listen, Mercedes does the GLA, which sells like crazy. They do a GLB. They have AMG versions of that, and those sell pretty darn well for AMG products.
But Japan doesn't do that for some reason.
But they could. I know they don't, but they could do that.
It's the same problem with the Land Cruiser 70, right?
I almost guarantee if they brought the LBX and the Yaris to the U.S., they would sell 10 times the Lexus.
All right, so now we've got a little, we'll do a little poll or something. I think the Yaris, GR Yaris would sell. You think the LBX would sell.
Do people buy more crossovers or...
And I think you like arguing with me just for the sake of
No, arguing. Dad, you have kind of a ridiculous argument here. Because do crossovers or hatchbacks sell better in the U.S.?
Do crossovers
or hatchbacks
crossovers sell much better?
By a ratio of like 25 to 1.
Yes, of course.
So why in the world would an LBX, which is a crossover, sell worse than a Yaris, which is a hatchback?
I think we should move on, Tommy.
There's a reason Volkswagen killed the Golf.
You don't have to prove me wrong. I think we can move
on. I'm just saying there's a reason Volkswagen killed the Golf and kept the Taos.
Well, because the Golf in its last generation was not grand.
It was awesome. The Mark 7 was the best Golf they ever did.
They kind of lost the plot, Tommy.
The Mark 8, lost the plot.
The Mark 2 was the best
Mark
Golf.
Mark 2?
Mark 2 was the best Golf ever. Anyway, I don't want to keep bickering. Let's just move on. So the next day was the hardest day, and that is when we went to the Tokyo Auto Salon, which, like I said, is like a SEMA of Japan, but it's not a trade show like SEMA is. It's a consumer show. That was just so hard because, oh my gosh, there were so many people everywhere. And this is one of the coolest cars there. Why don't you tell them what this is?
Yes, this is a big trend I see in Japan. A lot of affordable small Toyotas and Hondas and Suzukis and whatever, where tuning companies will actually face swap them and put different wheels and different rear ends on them and then make them look vintage or make them look like something they're not. So this is a company called Cal's Motor, which took, I think this is a Toyota or a Honda crossover.
They made it look like a Caprice.
Yeah, they made it look a little bit like a Caprice or maybe a Chevette. But look, it's American, right? It's got the chrome wheels. It's got, this was 4.9 million yen. It's like $32,000. It's got some vintage-looking upholstery on the inside. And then out back, it's got some pretty wild-looking taillights, chrome door handles. I see this a lot.
Oh my God, look at the back of this.
Yeah, look, from an American standpoint, we probably think it's kind of ugly, but I like the whimsy about it. There's something really fun about it.
No, I agree, and we saw so many interesting cars. And if you guys have been on TFL Talk. Last week, of course, we ran a walkthrough of the Tokyo Auto Salon. And so I don't want to necessarily spend a lot of time recouping that, because you can go back and you can watch last week's episode. To me, the most interesting part car there was the little Jimny, and it's in all of its variations and all of its forms. I think the one that really stood out was the one that they made look like a G-Wagon.
Yes, there's a Suzuki, and then there's a company that sells a body kit that makes it look exactly like a G-Wagon. It's got the G-Wagon hood and side pipes and tail lights. It's crazy. I don't know how they don't get sued. And there's a lot of like the really interesting tuning community in Japan. A lot of super lowered cars, a lot of wide body stuff. Liberty Walk was your favorite company, right?
Yeah, Liberty Walk is an interesting Japanese tuner. And what they do is all the other tuners at the show basically sell parts to make your car go faster. Liberty Walk sells parts to make your car go slower. And what I mean by that is they sell wide body kits, and they do crazy things like putting wide body kits on one of the 1,500 Ferrari F40s that's left in the world. Maybe there's less than that because that's how many they built. We're talking donor cars are probably in the $1 million range, and the body kit is without paint another $125,000. And basically, they'll make an F40 as a wide body Ferrari. And then to add to the slowness, they'll also stance it. So they put giant wheels that, of course, are not square, but
crazy camber.
Crazy camber. And it's a really kind of a unique status symbol in Japan to be able to take a classic Italian car. They did a Miura when we were there, and make it wide body and make it stance. And I kind of fell in love with it.
I mean, I never really understood it, because you're making your car kind of worse, right, from a car standpoint, if you just want it to work as a car. But what I did like about a lot of those tuning companies we saw in Japan was there was a lot of whimsy to everything they were doing, with crazy exhausts and huge body kits and crazy wings. And like, I appreciate that they're not following the rules. They don't really care what like a lot of people think. They just do something because they think it's art and they think it's cool. And I kind of respected that. I feel like a lot of the tuning community in America is driven based on other people's opinions of your car, where in Japan you can just do whatever you want. And a lot of people are going to hate it, but there's probably going to be a few people that like it. And I think that's pretty neat.
I think the reason that Liberty Walk is so successful, because it was definitely the star of the show, is you're living in a society that is all about rules.
Sure.
And they're the ones, they're the rebels who are out there breaking all the rules. And they're breaking the most important rules, which is, taking what much of the world and Japan considers these low production classic vintage Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and doing things to them that you see mostly on like clapped out Honda Accords.
Sure, yeah.
And that is, I think, very successful and very cool and very profitable. And I know that because I bought a Liberty Walk sweatshirt, hoodie, and I didn't do the conversion when I bought it. How much do you think that hoodie I bought cost?
$80.
$125.
Yeah, and in the U.S., like
that
some
was quite
of,
the eye-opening statement in the Visa.
Some of the jackets that they sell in the U.S. are like $500, but yeah, it's
people
like
were saying I could flip that for like $250.
It's a brand, right?
Yeah.
People are. It's a status symbol. It's kind of like Hoonigan, right, in the U.S., but even more so, where it's like it's a cool thing to be wearing and to have the cool sticker, and that, I think that's pretty cool that they turn that into a brand. So yeah, a lot of stuff I typically wouldn't like. Also, kind of a surprising number of off-roaders we saw. Like, we saw a huge number of Jimneys. Saw quite a few Land Cruisers, the one we get in the States, the 250 series.
Tons of G-Wagons.
Lots of G-Wagons, yeah. And there's not a huge off-road community compared to the U.S. In Japan, they do have parks, and they do have a big Jimny world. But compared to like our wide open spaces, it's not quite the same. But even still, people were doing some cool stuff.
And there were some cool cars for all of you traditionalists. So they showed the new upcoming Prelude.
Yes, that's right.
Almost production ready, I thought.
Oh, and the coolest one. I'm sorry, Subaru? I keep going to my phone.
SCI?
No, that was a mess because it was a 210 and it was lower power than people expected. And it was a
CVT.
CVT only. That was
anyway, if you want to see all this, just watch last week's show.
But there is something I do want to shout out. I'm going onto my phone here to find the name of it.
Okay.
Because it is kind of a big deal. Toyota has pulled the covers off of an engine called the G20E, which is essentially the GR Corolla engine with the four-cylinder. So it's a four-cylinder high-compression.
Instead of a three-cylinder.
Yeah, high-compression turbo engine.
And they're going to use it in their racing programs.
They were saying they're going to use it initially in the racing, but it's going to end up in production programs.
And then we're thinking it could either go into the upcoming, and we know we saw this preview not last year, Yeah, last year at the Toyota Motor Show, into the MR2, which we know is coming. So there's a mid-engine.
And the potentially the upcoming Celica.
Or do you say Celica? I like Celica. I like the way the words say it.
So the way they tease like that MR2 mid-engine layout is they had a prototype GR Yaris that had that engine in the trunk, right? And that was what they were kind of showing and teasing.
Build it, Toyota. Take my money. Build it. Either a Celica or an MR2. I'm you know, the MR2, so my friend Fred had one. He had the second generation. The first generation was cool but kind of slow. The second generation, the supercharged one, was much quicker.
Other way.
Sorry, so the second generation. Yeah, you're right.
It's turbo in the second gen, supercharged in the first, I think,
but
yeah.
But anyway, you know, I mean, But the Celica, that really has my heart.
Why?
Because
I feel like you got that backwards.
No, I don't have that backwards because you weren't around, unfortunately, Tommy, in the late 70s and early 80s when Japanese cars really took off in America. And we, as car enthusiasts, my friend Mark, who had a Celica, never saw something like the Celica or the Supra at the time. And basically, you know, in America, if you wanted a sporty car, you had a couple of choices. You can get a crappy MG, you know, that you'd have to rebuild every 200 miles, right? Mm. All those British cars were here. Or you could go American Muscle, you know, which was, you know, the mullet, you know, party on the back, which, you know, my friend also had one of those, my friend Kuda, which were cool, but not very sophisticated. And then the Japanese basically came and you can get a Corvette, right? But very expensive and kind of an old man car. But the Japanese showed up with the RX-7, with the Celica, with the Supra, and made sports cars affordable.
No, I think you're right.
That's why it was so cool.
Like, Celica Supras are very cool. Supras, obviously, very neat.
Yeah.
The standard Celicas, though, like, unless you got, like, the later, the turbo all-wheel drive ones, those were awesome. But, like, a lot of Celicas were kind of like Preludes, where they were just kind of...
But
sporty looking.
Imagine the world we live in with LTDs roaming the streets.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
All of a sudden,
the sleek and sporty and cool sports car shows up that I could afford. So my first car that I bought with my own money for $12,000 at the time was a Mazda RX-7.
Right.
Right? And I had a choice. I could go get myself a Camaro, which everybody had, or I could do something different. And if you were the kind of person that I am, which is a contrarian, and you want something different, then the Japanese offered a breath of fresh air.
But the MR2 was mid-engined, which was awesome. And it was rear-wheel drive.
It was slow.
But it was supercharged.
It didn't handle very well.
Oh, that is fighting words.
And it was tiny.
MR2s handled like crazy. They're super well-handling cars.
Why didn't they, you know, why did they stop?
So, because no one buys sports cars. This is what it comes back down to.
But back then, they were buying sports cars.
There is a lady who autocrosses a bone stock MR2,
yeah,
who runs circles around modern cars. That is how fast some of those later MR2s are.
Maybe she's a very good driver.
She is a good driver, but the car is also amazing.
I don't know. The MR2 just didn't have that it factor. It was once again like the Japanese cop trying to do their version of a classic mid-engine sports car, and it just didn't pull it off. Oof. In my mind.
You're going to get some hate on that.
That's fine. I get it.
I think,
from your generation looking back, it's much different than from my generation that was, you know, that lived it.
I think MR2s were pretty cool back then, too. I've talked to some folks in their 80s like you.
Thanks, Tommy.
It seems genuinely like people like...
That was like half a step cooler than a Del Sol.
No, it was a lot cooler than the Del Sol.
No, that's kind of where I would put it.
Del Sols were front-wheel drive Civic stuff. This was a bespoke mid-engine platform.
You walked into the Toyota dealership and you could have you can walk into the Toyota dealership and there was a Paseo and there was an MR2, right? Right.
But a Paseo was not, a Paseo, that's not, what are you talking about? A Paseo was based on a Echo.
I know.
They were awful. MR2s was a bespoke mid-engine platform with a manual transmission.
No, the Toyota Supra Mark IV was awesome.
Mark IV is...
Nissan 300ZX twin turbo, which I bought, was awesome.
Yes.
The MR2 was just they didn't quite get it.
ZR2s, Z32s were awesome. Mark IV Supras are also very awesome. But for the day, the MR2s were fantastic. They were really neat.
You can have an argument with Fred, who bought one.
Look,
the charm wore off.
The other thing I learned recently,
they also had no room, so they, you know,
one of the
if you wanted to go like on a road trip, they were impractical for that.
One of the long-term Toyota product people there, really interesting guy, super knowledgeable, told me something interesting. We always idolize Mark IV Supras nowadays for being the holy grail. He said back when they were new in the 90s, they weren't selling in America.
Yeah,
they
were, because people hadn't figured out you could tune them within an inch of their
sure,
life.
Maybe, but they were sitting on showroom floors.
I know, because the 300 ZX Twin, I lived at Tommy, so I know I was there. The 300 ZX Twin Turbo had 300 horsepower, and the reason you would buy the Super over that wasn't because of reliability, it was because it had 320 horsepower. Of course, all the buff books read them, and they liked that better. You also had the Mitsubishi, VR4?
3000 GT.
3000 GT, which had, just a boatload of technology, including all-wheel steering, active aero, but it was really heavy. So let's move on, and let's go to the final thing that we did. And Cole, there's three videos up there. Let's run that one, yeah, the one you were by, the longest one. So what is this that we're looking at, Tommy?
So we went to kind of a Japanese enthusiast car meets at a interesting, essentially, car stop or truck stop.
It? Yeah, could you pause it, Cole?
It was a floating, it's a man-made structure built in the middle of the bay. It's called Daikoku, and it's kind of like just a rest stop for cars. But several nights a week, enthusiasts gather there and bring their cool cars, and it was a kind of a pop-up car show, which
yeah,
is cool.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the highways, you can see three level of highways that circle this little parking lot rest stop. And what makes it so cool is that, if you have a GTR, if you have a Liberty Walk GTR, this is where you go on Friday or Saturday night to kind of show off, because it's on its own little island. And then the roads to there are dead straight. So I was talking to our guide, and he was saying because they're dead straight and because they have little apps in Japan where they know where the speeding cameras are, you can either see the police or you know where the cameras are. So you can drive there very quickly or leave there very quickly, which is nice. But I did a walk around, so let's roll the video. This was as close to Fast and Furious as I could get in Japan.
It was really neat to be able to experience it, yeah. And once again, we saw a lot of these kind of crazy cars from the show in person with some really amazing, crazy graphics and ground effects and wheels and exhaust systems and wings. And it was just so cool to be able to be in outside of Tokyo and seeing this. So the show ended very early. This was essentially a Nissan Leaf. That was not very cool on the right there.
There's a GTR leaving.
Yeah, R34 GTR and all these Halo cars, Mark IV Supras.
There's Liberty Walk GTR.
S14s and just the wildest stuff in person.
Pause it, Cole, would you? So there you have what Liberty Walk does. You can see it's a wide body kit. You can see that giant front spoiler. And like you said, they turned this into a brand, and I really fell in love with that. Of course, yeah. I don't have the money for this kind of customization. But keep going, Cole. But the one thing I took away from this meet was that the GTR is still Godzilla. There's another GTR. Oh, that's a Supra, sorry. The GTR is right there, and there's a Supra. The GTR is still Godzilla, at least in Japan, when it comes to the top dog at their Cars and Coffee, or yeah. Cars and Sushi.
Yeah, it was really cool to be able to kind of experience that. So definitely a bucket list moment. Anybody can go. There were a lot of Westerners there. Like, it didn't feel super, super authentic Japanese, but it was just a local car meet that people attend, and it was awesome to be able to see some of the Japanese car culture. And interestingly, there were two Mustangs there. There were zero Mustangs at the Tokyo Auto Salon, but two at that car meet, which I thought was pretty funny. So there was our kind of our overview of our trip to Japan.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to thank again Toyota for hosting us and having us experience all these really great things. These are all bucket list moments. I have to say it was one of the best programs I've ever been on. Certainly something I'll remember for the rest of my life. And I'm glad that, we got to take you along with us. That's what makes me, get up in the morning.
For sure, yeah. And folks, if you have comments, we'd love to read them in below. What would sell better, Yaris or LBZ? And what was a cooler car, the MR2 or the Celica? Those are our big debates of today's show.
Yeah, we should do like a little like jingle, right? Because we bicker so much, so we could
do like a little poll down below.
Yeah.
But this has been Tommy.
And Roman saying thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Ciao.
Bye, guys.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.